We come to chapter 11 of the book of Genesis. Up till now, the authors, the post-exilic authors, have been putting together stories that somehow contain some of their insights into the meaning of our life and our existence. And it culminated in the story of the flood, which they picked up from the Mesopotamian area. And after the flood, life is the way it is, partly good, partly not good, and God is seemingly content to live with human beings who are sinning but good. Chapter 11 concludes this part of the book of Genesis, and it's an extraordinarily strange story in a way. And it links with their experience in Babylon, and they then link it to the beginnings of their, I'll call it history, for want of a better word, with Abraham. Their Ab means father in Hebrew, and Ram means high. So it's hardly a name, it's their high father. The origins of their particular people, the Israelites. What you're seeing there is the story of the Tower of Babel. I'll look at the text in a moment in a bigger font, but just here I wanted you just to see the art of it. You can see I've got a one there and a one down there, and a two and a two and a three and a three and a three, and here's the central part here. So it's a diptych, it's parallels, and the language is parallel too. I don't want to take you right through it, but you can probably see, for example, here in six, city and a tower, city and a tower. Let us built, and bricks, which is Lebanim, and Balal is confused, and Babel is, they're playing on words all the way through here. And the central point of it all, this, which we'll come to in a second, is here. The hinge of the whole story. Very nicely worked out story is Yahweh came down to see. So there's a lot happening, and of course it's a childlike image. God is up there in the highest heavens, and God comes down to see what on earth is going on in his world. Just as we saw earlier in the flood, the hinge was, it said, and God remembered. Here, it's God coming down to see that brings about the situation we now know. Looking at the text a little bit more, we can see it. The first half of the text reads this way. It happened, you could say once upon a time, it happened that the whole world had one language and one vocabulary. And as they journeyed from the east, of course, all the journeys come from the east because that's the sun, they found a plain in the land of Shinar. Now, the word Shinar occurs throughout the Bible. It's that area of the land where Babylon is. So that's what it's basically referring to. And they settled there. And each one said to his neighbor, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." Now that's all right, except that the people who are reading this haven't got the foggiest idea what bricks are, because they're working with stone. They didn't work. They needed bricks over there because they've got clay and they had to do it. They didn't have lovely stone as they have in Judah. So they put a little explanation here for the readers. Oh, they used brick for stone and they used bitumen for mortar, these ancient peoples over there. And they said, come, let's build for ourselves. We're right back with Adam and Eve and wanting to be like God on their own, independent of God. Well, here it is here. Let's build a tower, build for ourselves a city and a tower with its summit touching the heavens. They want to build their own way up to heaven. And we'll make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered over the face of the earth. So to stay together and to build this one language, city, and a tower, well, we'll build our own way to heaven. However, Yahweh came down to see what on earth was going on. And then everything unfolds. Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower, that the sons of Adam, well, it just means human beings, really, all of that, had built. And Yahweh said, see, they are one people. They all have one language. And this is only the beginning of what they'll do. Just as Adam and Eve in the garden ate from the fruit of good and evil, but that's only the beginning. We, God, better get them out of the garden of paradise, lest they reach up and grasp the fruit of the tree of life. Well, likewise here, if we don't stop them, they're going to work their own way up to heaven, says God. They have one people and they have one language, and that's only the beginning of what they'll do. Henceforth, nothing will be impossible for them in what they promise to do. Come, we, that's the royal plural for God, we'll go down and confuse their language, from the Hebrew nabal. Nabla, so that each one will not understand the language of the other, of the neighbor. So Yahweh scattered them. They were going to build up this tower precisely so they wouldn't be scattered. No, Yahweh scattered them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. For this reason, they called the city Babel. Babylon, surely. Because there Yahweh mixed up, confused the language of the whole world. From there Yahweh scattered them over the face of the earth. A very simple story with a bit of a go at Babylon. We'll come back to that. But they're just trying to explain, why does everyone speak so many different languages and why are we all over the world? Well, that's their story to talk about it. Something to do with God's will. On the left there, you can see a ziggurat. That's what you see if you looked at it, near Babylon. See, they had this. They built a tower, and up the top of the tower was a temple to the god of the moon, the goddess of the moon. So that's what they saw there. And here you've got an artistic reconstruction of what it might have looked like. And it was also strange to the Jews in exile, because these people didn't have any mountains. It's all alluvial plain, of course. They didn't have any mountains, and we've got these wonderful big mountains, and they have to build their own way up to God, and whereas we've got God with us all the time. All of that is part of their thinking. So the text commentary is a condemnation of the pride and power of the kingdom of Babylon. Wanted to be one empire, wanted to control the whole of their world, attempting to crush subject peoples, including Judah. In chapter 10, the earlier chapter, we've been introduced to a list of many peoples, each with their own identity and language. Babylon wants to impose its own gods and its own language on others, but God thwarts their efforts. The repetition of phrases in a reverse structure, which I've in short done with you, dramatizes the truth that human action, when conceived without proper obedience to God, achieves the opposite result to that intended. The reversal comes from the action of God, whose power cannot be usurped by humankind. They want to make a name for themselves. Well, the name they ended up getting was Babel, Babylon, confusion. The name they make is confusion, a pun on the name Babylon. They are determined to reach the heavens by their own power and to create everything in Babylon, but they fail. And by the time this is written, of course, the Persian Empire under Cyrus has conquered the Babylonian Empire. I'll read to you from the satire on the death of the king of Babylon that we find in Isaiah chapter 14, and it reads, "You said in your heart, 'I will ascend to heaven, I'll raise my throne above the stars of God. I'll sit on the mount of assembly on the heights of Zaphon.'" That was the Semitic equivalent of Olympus for the Greeks, up in the north mountain, where the gods assembled and so on. "I will ascend to the tops of the clouds. I'll make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to Sheol, to the depths of the pit." I hope you can see that Isaiah's statement parallels this story of the building the tower. Ezekiel has similar language about Tyre and the Pharaoh of Egypt. Ezekiel writing from Babylon. The story of Babel makes two links with history. First, there's the link with Babylon, and secondly, it's this confusion and this scattering that God wishes to reverse when he calls, and we'll look at it later this morning, he calls Abraham out of this area to bring harmony and peace and embrace the whole world, to be a father of many nations. God is calling Avram, our high father, right back in before history. "All the tribes of the earth will bless themselves by you." God is going to undo what the Babylonians tried to do in pride. God will bring the world together with one language. And by the way, this is what's behind the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 2, when they all hear in their own language. Because what Peter's speaking is the language of love, which transcends all of our languages. And they all hear what Peter is saying, even though they speak different languages. Just as we are in this room, they're all brought together into a community of faith. Abraham is chosen by God to show God's merciful design to call human beings out of the confusion effected by their sin into the sacred harmony of being God's holy people. Human beings cannot make their own way to heaven, but God can come down as he does on Sinai. Here's a statement we find in the prophecy of Isaiah and in the prophecy of Micah. So it must have been a loose statement around, and they've linked it in with two of the prophets. Not quite sure who it comes from. I'll just read it to you. "In days to come," this is the hope and the promise, "the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. All nations will stream to it. Many people will come and say, come, let's go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. I'm sure you can already feel the power of this kind of literature for a man like Paul, who was so pure in his love for Judaism and so determined to get rid of any opposition, so-called. Anyone claiming a Galilean was the Messiah, it's hopeless for Paul. He was so pure about it, but then when he came to be enlightened and see what it was all about, all this stuff fed into his desire to get to the ends of the world and to draw the whole world into love, into the Christian fold. The text from Isaiah or Micah goes on, he shall judge between the nations and shall arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares. God is not interested in what Babylon was doing by violence producing an empire of control. They will beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in Yahweh's light. The prophet Zechariah, who was there at the return from exile, so around the same time this is all being composed. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, people shall yet come, the inhabitants of many cities. The inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, come, let's go and entreat the favour of Yahweh and seek Yahweh of hosts. I myself am going. Many peoples and strong nations will come to seek Yahweh of hosts in Jerusalem, not in Babylon, in Jerusalem, and entreat the favour of Yahweh. So that story, which we now completed, is followed by an appendix, which I'll now do with you. And it links the primitive narrative, primeval narrative, with the patriarchal sagas. I'll do it in a moment, I'll just talk about it here. It gives the genealogy, up till now our genealogies have been from Adam through to Noah. That's as far as it's gone, and Noah has three sons, and then they proportion the world between these three sons, we've done that. But what this genealogy does, it's a priestly genealogy, it takes us from Shem, one of the sons of Noah, and the founder of the Semites, right through to Abraham. So they're making the link. Now, it's not a link that stands up historically, of course, but they're giving names to make the link. It's all from the priestly redaction, so God's blessing is continuing through. And it's a transition from primeval narrative to the history, perhaps better, story of the patriarchs. Like the genealogy from Adam to Noah, there are 10 generations. So this is quite arbitrary. So they've got 10. The 10th person of the earlier genealogy was Noah. The 10th person of this genealogy, starting with Shem, is Abram. So just as Adam and Eve with Seth, started a new beginning with 10 in it, leading to Noah. So he's a new beginning too with Abram. Something wonderful is going to happen because he's the 10th one down from Shem. As in the earlier genealogy, the numbers differ between the Hebrew, Samaritan and Greek versions. So don't take the numbers literally, for heaven's sake. The sum total in the Hebrew Masoretic text is 390 of these 10 generations. In the Samaritans it's 1041, and in the Greek it's 1270. So they all give different numbers. Note the agreement, we'll see it now, with the Yahwist. Because back in chapter 10, we're in chapter 11 now, back in chapter 10 the Yahwist gave just a small smattering of names. Shem, Arpachshad, Shelah, Eber and Peleg. And we actually noted where they were on the geographical map of the day. Well, this agrees with them, but it adds further ones. Let's look at it. These are the descendants of Shem. When Shem was 100 years old, and you're used to this kind of language, except the numbers are much smaller now. When Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arpachshad, 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after the birth of Arpachshad 500 years, and he had other sons and daughters. That must ring a, you can hear earlier genealogies there. When Arpachshad had lived 35 years, he became the father of Shelah. And Arpachshad lived after the birth of Shelah 403 years, and he had other sons and daughters. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he became the father of Eber. And Shelah lived after the birth of Eber 403 years and had other sons and daughters. And when Eber had lived 34 years, he became the father of Peleg. And Eber lived after the birth of Peleg 430 years and had other sons and daughters. And when Peleg had lived 30 years, he became the father of Reu. And Peleg lived after the birth of Reu 209 years. And everyone knows how it's going to end. And he had other sons and daughters. So they're remembering. Good way of teaching. Twice one or two, twice two or four. It all takes us back to our childhood. Goes on. When Reu had lived 32 years, he became the father of Serug. And Reu lived after the birth of Serug 207 years and had other sons and daughters. When Serug had lived 30 years, he became the father of Nahor. And Serug lived after the birth of Nahor 200 years and had other sons and daughters. And when Nahor had lived 29 years, they're getting younger and younger as they have kids now, 29 years, he became the father of Terah. And Nahor lived after the birth of Terah 119 years and had other sons and daughters. And when Terah had lived 70 years, 70 is a bit of a perfection word, he became the father, we've arrived, at Avram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, the priests don't want to leave anything out. This is the story of Terah. I'm getting the grandfather of Abram, so this is important. This is the story of Terah. Terah was the father of Abram, Nahor and Haran. Haran was the father of Lot. Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his birth, in Ur of the Chaldees, right down on the Persian Gulf, where the two rivers meet, Tigris and Euphrates, and run into the Persian Gulf. Avram and Nahor took wives. The name of Avram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. Sarai means princess, and I'm pretty sure Milcah means queen. She was the daughter of Haran and the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now, Sarai was barren. She had no child. Terah took his son Avram and his grandson Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abraham's wife, and they went out together from Ur in the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. And they've got to go up, they can't go across the desert, so they've got to go up and then down. And when they came to Haran, which is in Syria, in Lebanon, Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now, heavens, we could go forever on this, and I don't want to because I don't find it interesting enough, probably. There are problems associating Abraham with the famous city of Ur. As noted above, Terah and Nahor are attested as place names from the area near Haran in Syria. And in the Bible, in Deuteronomy, Abram is called, he's not related to Ur, he's called to be a wandering Aramean. Aram is Syrian. So that's where they come from. The link with Ur, which is only in this text, is highly unlikely. So our story really begins just north of the Promised Land, in Aram. What I've got for you there is, and I'll just show it to you and then leave it. The Genesis account we've just started is on the left-hand side there. Shem, Apashad, Shelah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Seru, Nahor, Terah, and the tenth one, Avram. Back in the earlier chapter, chapter 10, which is the priest, the Yahweh's document, the first five of those are mentioned already. Luke's Gospel, and this has some interest for us, I'm sure. Luke's Gospel, I've got it there on the right-hand side. Luke, Matthew in his genealogy, which is no better or worse than any of these genealogies, it's not an accurate ancestry.com or anything. Matthew's desire is to link Jesus through Joseph, through the father, because that's how things handed down, through Joseph back to Abram. And you might remember he has 14, three lots of 14. So there's the group going back to the exile, and then there's the group going back to David, and there's the group from David to Abraham. That's what Matthew does. Luke has another idea. He wants to show that Jesus belongs, yes, he does belong to Abram, to us, but he belongs to the whole human race. So he has him going right, and this is the text. It's in reverse order, of course, because he's starting with Jesus and working backwards. Son of Abraham, son of Terah, Nahor, and he takes exactly, that's where he gets his material from, this text. He traces it back to Shem. And then Luke goes on, son of Noah, Lamech, then he goes through the earlier one of the priests, going right back to Adam. And Adam is the son of God. So that's just our New Testament borrowing from these genealogies which we've been reading. So we conclude this, and I prepare you now for the patriarchs. In the myths of the ancient Near East, The story of the beginnings leads directly to the establishment of the monarchy, of the Pharaoh, or of the king of Babylon. Their purpose of these ancient Near Eastern myths was to provide a stable and divine foundation for the king's reign, supported by the temple cult. As we've already noted, the stories of the beginnings of Genesis do not take the form of myth. Their aim is not to establish the kingdom, stable kingdom. They have a different purpose. The primeval narratives in Genesis doesn't reach a climax with the king and the temple cult. It introduces the patriarchs, the ancient ancestors of the people of Israel. The authors draw on stories handed down through the generations and retell them in terms that address the interests and concerns of their contemporaries. Just as Christians read the Old Testament in the light of Jesus' revelation, and we shouldn't read it except through his eyes, so the people of Israel read these patriarchal stories, which we're about to begin, in the light of the revelation given to Moses. They were a kind of Old Testament. The book of Genesis is the Old Testament for the Old Testament, for the Hebrew Scriptures, in which they expected to find material that was a preparation for, but not always consistent with, their own religious practices as spelt out in the other books of the Torah, the Moses books, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. They're all about the Torah. So this Genesis is preparing us for that. This is particularly noticeable in the way God and God's relationship to human beings are portrayed in the patriarchal narratives. There's no sense in them, and we'll watch this, but it's actually quite beautiful. There's no sense in them of religious antagonism. Other nations are not rejected because they worship false gods. Everyone is assumed to be relating to the one God. This is true of Abram, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, whom we'll study, but it's also true of Abimelech, a Canaanite king, and the Pharaoh of Egypt. They're considered to be part of God's design. Furthermore, God relates in the Genesis stories, he doesn't in the Moses stories. He relates to people directly, without the mediation of priests or prophets. Religious cult is simple family worship in the home, quite different from that prescribed in Mosaic Yahwism. The patriarchal narratives are quite subtle theological reflections, and I hope to bring this out for you because they're beautifully written, quite amazing literature. The patriarchal narratives are quite subtle theological reflections. They're looking for the meaning of life, again, they're looking for, and the stories are not telling us all about it, because you can't get that till you get to Torah, till you get to Exodus, but they're hinting at it and preparing us for it. And they move now from once upon a time, which is the beginnings of the first 11 chapters of Genesis, that kind of portrayal of God, through the patriarchal period and up to the revelation of Moses. Stories are meant to be listened to, not explained. Some explanations, however, is needed Because these stories found a fixed form some 2,500 years ago in a culture very different from our own. They didn't need it explained, but we do, just as we need to study Shakespeare, whereas the riffraff that went to the Globe Theatre, they laughed at all the jokes. They didn't need a footnote to tell us what this meant and what that meant. And what. They just saw the humour straight away because it's their language. But it's not ours, so we do some kind of work is needed. And if you read T.S. Eliot, you need a book for every blooming line in it to explain it because it's so full of references that we're not at home with immediately. So stories are meant to be listened to, but this was written a long time ago. So we're not simply listening to stories from chapter 12 to chapter 50. We're reading an ancient report. Our hope is that, like the seeds discovered in the chambers of ancient Egypt, these stories might come alive again for us. All we know of Abraham is from the texts we're about to read. There are no inscriptions mentioning Abraham. There's no document outside the Bible. There's no monuments that speak of him. A very simple way to put it is that Abraham never existed. Someone must have existed, but these are just stories to tell about the meaning of their current faith. So they're creating stories. Some of these stories may have inspired the people of Judah as they grew into a tribe, as they became a kingdom, as they found themselves caught between the aspirations of Egypt and the kingdoms of Mesopotamia, as they experienced the exile and were trying to rebuild after the exile. They were inspired by these religious narratives. They were also sacred to those Jews who became disciples of Jesus. And through them, they've continued to be treasured as stories of the origins of the Christian community. Similarly, for the people of Islam, some centuries later. So let us therefore allow our imagination to be captured by these stories in the hope that they may inspire us who, in Paul's words to the Romans, share the faith of Abraham, the father of us all. And when they talk about the three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all looking back to these records, these powerful religious statements about what life's really about and what it's meant to be. The stories that were handed down in the folklore and legends of Judah have been reshaped to present Abraham as a model for those who are going to be obedient to the Torah. Now you're into history, Moses and so on. Ezekiel tells us that those who stayed behind in Judah during the exile thought the land should remain in their hands. Because when everyone was carted off to exile, of course people took over the land because they're never going to come back. So the land was all sorted out and distributed. Then all these people come back full of enthusiasm and a new exodus, coming back with their leader, Zerubbabel, and then they find all their land's gone and there's argument and there's dispute and all the rest of it. The inhabitants of these waste places in the land of Israel kept saying, this is Ezekiel, Abraham was only one man, yet he got possession of the land. We're many. The land is surely given to us to possess. The post-exilic authors want to show that Abraham is also the father of the returned exiles. So they must have been given land and etc. He belongs to us all. not just to the people who stayed behind. In reading these stories, we're in touch with the questions, the dreams, the hopes, the disappointments of post-exilic Judah. And if you read them as though you're hearing them for the first time, and you've been in exile, and you've come back, and Jerusalem has been destroyed, there are no walls, there's no temple, and you're now coming to a little landlocked area called Yehud, and you haven't got access to the sea, and you've got no trade, and the place is in a mess, and you've got all these civil problems too as well, and you've got different priestly groups vying for control, and you've got them saying, we'll never offend God anymore, so every Jew who's married to a Moabite or an Aramite or any Edomite, your wife has to go and your kids have to go, we've got to be a pure race, you have ethnic cleansing going on. It's a difficult time. So that's where you are, and that's where these stories are trying to build you up into something better than what's happening. They'd been through the destruction of their city and the terrible experience of exile. As they understand it, this was because they'd broken the covenant made with Moses. It was important for them to remember that there was an older covenant, an older promise, an unconditional one given by God to the patriarchs before Moses. A promise, a covenant, if you like, made by God that transcended human fidelity and infidelity. Yes, we were unfaithful and we think it was God punishing us, but hang on, there's something more fundamental than that. There are these promises that were given to our high father, our ancestor, Abraham. Abraham believed in God's commitment, so must they, for in their faith lay their hope. Genesis chapter 11, the last verses, locates Abram and his wife Sarai in Ur of the Chaldees, the most famous city right down south. Abram is linked to Shem, we've seen this, through his father Terah. And through Shem, he's linked to Noah. And through Noah, he's linked to Seth, and so to Adam. The origins of the ancient father of Israel, Abram, go back to the very beginning of human history. That's their claim. So I'll read again and conclude. These are the descendants of Terah. Terah was the father of Avram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran was the father of Lot. Haran died before his father Terah on the land of the north of his birth in Ur of the Chaldees. Abram and Nahor took wives, and he gives the names of the wives, but Sarai was barren and had no child. Terah took his son Avram and his grandson Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there in Syria. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So the first 11 chapters of Genesis have brought us to Syria, where Abram and his wife and his nephew are living. And then the story will unfold in the next episode. And I'll conclude now with